Support for Commodity Week comes from the Friends of WILL and from Strategic Farm Marketing in Champaign. With crop insurance, grain marketing, and commodity brokerage services. Learn more at sfarmmarketing.com.
This is the March 2 edition of Commodity Week.
Support for agricultural programs comes from AgriGold, celebrating their 13th year as a major corporate underwriter of Illinois Public Media's ag programming and e-newsletter. AgriGold's support allows their customers and growers everywhere to receive quality ag information at no charge. More information on AgriGold can be found at AgriGold.com.
Todd Gleason services are made available to WILL by University of Illinois Extension.
And welcome to Commodity Week. I am Todd Gleason from University of Illinois Extension. Our panelists today include Elaine Cubb from Mastering the Grain Markets out of Elkhorn, Nebraska, Joe Vaklubek of Standard Grain from Chicago, Illinois, and Dan Zwicker at Zwicker Consulting out of Waco, Texas. Commodity Week is a production of Illinois Public Media. Find us online at willag.org, willag.org. There you can still buy your tickets for the All-Day Ag Outlook. That's next Tuesday at the Beef House in Covington, Indiana. $30 for the whole day. We'll have a baker's dozens worth of analysts there. We'll talk about farm policy, and Eric Snodgrass will be along to look at the weather forecast for South America as their Safrina crop comes along for corn and the United States this summer. Just $30. Buy your tickets right now online, willag.org. That's next Tuesday at the Beef House in Covington, Indiana. One of the people that will be there is Dan Zwicker at Zwicker Consulting out of Waco, Texas. He joins us now. Hey, Dan, thanks so much for being with us today. Can you give me a list of items you'd like to talk about on Commodity Week, please?
Well, I suppose the item of the week was the rumors of renewable fuels, whether it be the biodiesel or a change in the ethanol mandate is probably the big news of the week. The other is probably higher interest rates and stronger dollar.
Joe Vaklubek.
The markets have acted really well here recently. I think that these ethanol rumors have something to do with that, but I think overall we've just got some general strength in the grain markets. You know, I think that as of yesterday, I read between the wheat contracts, Chicago, Kansas City, Minneapolis, funds may have actually been net long for the first time in more than 3 years. Funds have totally shifted their position in the corn market to a net long. The other thing is crop insurance, spring guarantees for soybeans especially, much, much better than last year. $8.85 last year, $10.19 this year. So that doesn't buy some bean acreage. I don't know what will.
And Joe Vaklubek, of course, is with Standard Grain from Mastering the Grain Markets in Elkhorn, Nebraska. Elaine Cubb, on your list for the day.
Well, Dan stole my number one topic, which is the strength of the dollar and the effects that a higher interest rate will have on agriculture. But I'll also say I'm definitely looking down the line toward more confidence in spring weather forecasts and how that could affect some upcoming planting decisions, especially based on these insurance prices that we now have.
Okay, so I'm going to point now everybody to willag.org, willag.org. You'll look for an 18-minute interview with Scott Irwin that I did earlier in the week, the day, in fact, that the RFS rumors came out, and prior to the idea that they had been denied, that will explain a lot about what those rumors were and how they worked. Let me go through them very quickly as I understand them at this point. The rumor on Tuesday of this week suggesting that there had been a deal made that would come out as an executive order from the Trump administration that would change where the blender RINs were credited to so that they would not have to be done at refineries and might be moved further down the line to the blenders themselves. So from a few folks that would be dealing with it to a whole bunch, that would have an impact on Carl Icahn, for instance, and his refinery and others. More importantly, part of that trade-off may be that E15 would be allowed into the U.S. gas pumps for the summer months. It can easily be done, already approved by EPA, most of the way, but would take some movement on EPA. Nothing from Congress so far would have to be done. And then the final part of that would be that biodiesel and the blender's tax credit might be put back into place. It usually is. It needs to be renewed by Congress, but that the push would be for it to be used on U.S. origin soybean oil only. Much of what has been coming into the country from Argentina has actually taken advantage of that tax credit when it is in place. So I think I summarized it correctly, Dan. What impact did it have, and will there be something from Washington, D.C. that finalizes some of those types of rules?
Well, I saw on the Twitter wire here today that the big agribusiness groups pulled out of the Renewable Fuels Association because of those rumors. So there there must be some financial dealings in that would hurt the big agribusiness giants, because they were not in favor of that. So I guess, you know, I would say if you live by the sword, you die by the sword. This is what you get when you get into government programs and government mandates and all this kind of stuff. So there must be some kind of impact that it would impact the big agribusiness giants versus the smaller ethanol plants of some kind. The other thing is I think the tax credit to U.S. Origin or grown crops fits perfectly into the Trump administration's America First program. And I think that could be very huge to U.S. soybeans. It never did make a lot of sense for me why we would want to subsidize foreign crops in biofuels. So I think this is something to kind of watch. And I'd say that would be the one that's most likely to materialize. So I think it's generally positive at the E15. My wife got a new Tacoma this year, and I noticed on the gas cap that you can use E15 in it. It's got E10 and E15, but no E85. So I don't know if that's common on the new 17 cars, that they all are kind of considered E15 compatible, but we still have a problem with the cars made prior to 2000, and there's still a lot of them driving around, especially here in Texas.
Right, so we'll see some of that coming out of Washington, D.C. as we move further into the year, and I suspect we'll hear a lot more from the RFA, the Renewable Fuels Association, and Growth Energy, and to some of those associations that are involved in ethanol production. Okay, so Joe Vaclavic, let's go back to what happened then on Tuesday, because I think this may have to do something with the general strength you talked about in the marketplace, and that funds have been buying. They're now net long. Will they continue to buy? And is it because commodities are a good buy at a low price, or they're a safe haven, or do you have other reasons?
I do think that compared to some other assets out there, the grain markets can be viewed as being cheap relative to what we've seen the last 10 years. You know, corn with a 3 in front of it, beans with a 10 in front of them, wheat with a 4 in front of them. Those are low prices relative to what we've seen the last 5 to 10 years. See, I do think that does have something to do with it. I also think that this time of year, as we get closer to the U.S. growing season, as the winter wheat crop comes out of dormancy, your weather risk is really greatly elevated. And I think that because of that, perhaps some of the large money managers out there, they may very well think that there's greater risk of upside at this point than downside. And they might be right. You know, we know that the story about South America is good. We saw Informa, as a matter of fact, raise their estimates for both Brazil corn and soybeans today by quite a bit. So we don't have any major problems there. But we've got U.S. weather risk. There's no doubt about it. We've got some dry areas in the plains, in HRW country. There's some dry areas that are creeping into the Corn Belt. I'm not too worried about that yet. But, you know, I think from a risk to reward standpoint, yeah, the grain markets don't look too bad compared to a lot of other things out there.
Elaine Cubb, Joe Vaclavic talked a little bit about South American crops, the fact that Informa came out with its numbers. Next week, USDA will release on Thursday the World Agricultural Supply and Demand Estimates. Will they change and update their soybean number from Brazil? Will it increase from 104 million metric tons? Many are well above that.
Yeah, I think it's certainly a possibility. I think that 104 million metric tons already is where USDA, they already made an adjustment based on what they already knew about a good crop there. So I don't know that we're necessarily going to see a major shift in the market from their global numbers on Thursday.
And then you also wanted to discuss the dollar. How does this work into the marketplace from your vantage point?
Well, there's a really strong, almost a consensus that the Fed will be looking at raising interest rates here in March. And certainly they have all of the economic data to justify doing so. And the stock market alone is churning to fresh record highs that are really quite overheated. And Janet Yellen and the rest of the Fed may really see a justification here to try and slow things down by raising some interest rates. But what that does for grains, of course, is to really cause the U.S. dollar index to churn higher relative to a lot of other currencies. It's above 100 points already this week. And that's traditionally a bearish argument for the grains. And I think we did see that here on Thursday and into the later part of the week. But I will caution that even the higher prices that we saw in the midweek based on these RFS rumors, all of this is really happening with quite low volume being traded in the grain markets right now. I think everybody's sort of distracted by the other markets. So I think it's pretty vulnerable to a lot of streaky trade right now.
You also had the strong dollar on your list of things to talk about, Dan Zwicker. Your view?
Well, I don't think a quarter percent interest rate hike really means a lot. I think that'll probably be priced in if that's maybe what the strength here today or the last several weeks we've had kind of strength in the dollar. I think in anticipation that the Fed would bump up interest rates another quarter percent or so. We're talking at relatively low interest rates compared to what we experienced in the late 70s and early 80s. So we got a long ways to go as far as bringing interest rates higher when you're still messing around with 1% or 2% type interest rates. I think the thing to watch that could be quite interesting is if the border adjustment tax gets traction. I think that may have more to do with a strengthening dollar than anything, if that would happen. At least that's what the comments consensus is that the dollar would strengthen as such that it would probably offset the border adjustment tax and the cost of goods at Walmart and your retail outfits that probably get hit the hardest on this border adjustment would be absorbed by a stronger dollar. Now, if that would happen, then I think U.S. exports could be dinged up a little bit or hurt. But I'm bullish the exports simply because of the Trump policy. And Trump is not against trade. He wants fair trade. And I think there's been enough pumped out into the public over the last couple of months that people do understand that the United States is just letting everybody take advantage of them. And I think the goal is to narrow that trade deficit. I think our trade deficit is right up against $1 trillion. And, you know, financially, we can't really afford that, especially in our current economic environment. So I do think that you're going to see a lot of buyers be more interested in buying U.S. commodities to kind of help narrow that trade deficit. So I think I want to be more bullish on exports even with a little stronger dollar. I mean, most of the reason that we're stronger compared to the other currencies is because they're manipulating their currencies cheaply lower, which is really not truly the fundamental case.
So we have a trade adjustment tax. I'm going to come back to you, Elaine, and then Joe, maybe you can jump in after this. Potentially being talked about, Mexico, the number one importer of U.S. corn, a stronger dollar. I know that Dan's laying out a case that says we'll export anyway. However, none of that seems to make sense in my mind with the economics. Can you help me understand one way or the other where you stand today?
Yeah, I was going to push back a little bit on what Dan was saying here. We have a trillion-dollar trade deficit, but the only sector of our economy that is pushing positive exports is agriculture. And our biggest, and for corn and soybeans, which is what we're really talking about on this show, like you said, the biggest customer for our corn is Mexico, $2.5 billion a year. Already, they are conducting trade missions to Brazil and Argentina to try and build relationships with those countries and those companies that could be that could take away our market share. So already, just by having an antagonistic relationship with that country or having them interpret antagonism coming from our executive branch, already I think our market share is being hurt there.
I don't know. I know that the exports have been very, very strong. You know, something at this point last year, the dollar was a good 10% cheaper than it is now, and it hasn't really hurt the exports a ton. So I don't know. I think that other factors are more important. I think that the South American production situation is hugely important. I think that just demand in general is important. It doesn't seem like the dollar is the biggest factor to me when it comes to exports, just because we've been so strong, despite a strong dollar here over the last year or so. I think it is a headwind, you know, on days like today where you get an update in the dollar and every commodity's down. You know, it has something to do with the intraday trade and with the money flow. But regard to exports, I just, after seeing what happened here the last year, year and a half, our corn and soybean exports especially so strong, despite, you know, what's been a 10% rally in the dollar over the last 12 months.
Well, I think Mexico needs the U.S. more than the U.S. needs Mexico. And if Mexico, they can fiddle around down there all they want to, but at the end of the day, if the U.S. turns off the key, they choke. And even if they did decide to buy some supplies from South America, we are still a global market, and that would just replace demand from someplace else, and they would come to the United States. But Mexico doesn't worry me a bit. I think they're just snorting around because they're just acting like a bunch of crybabies down there. They've been taking advantage of us for years, and now they're wanting to pay the piper. That's just the same way with the EU countries. We've been defending them from NATO for years. It's time for them to cough up and spend some money. So I'm not too worried about any trade war with Mexico, because I think they need us more than what we need them.
So let me see if I can get this right. So on the trade adjustment tax, NAFTA, those sorts of things, I guess, would everybody be willing to say, and the U.S. dollar too, that it is neutral to friendly? And I know, Dan, you're probably friendlier than that, but is everybody okay with that kind of categorization? I'm going to try to see where we stand. Does that make sense to you, Elaine and Joe?
I'll say
I'm not too concerned
yet,
about the
so
currency
I guess you'd
situation.
Say
I think we're going to export as the need is there. I think that the demand, as it relates to the dollar, at least, is really pretty inelastic.
And that's the point, isn't it? Demand is inelastic for the countries that import U.S. corn, relatively speaking.
It appears that way to me. I mean, that's what the last year would tell you.
Okay, I think that gives us that position. So let's talk about the other things then. And maybe we should come back to South America and Brazil, their safrinha corn crop. It started out in going into the ground right now, in fact, at a pretty quick pace. However, they've had an awful lot of rain, and we'll get to the trucks that are in line down there on BR-163 here in just a moment. But is there enough of a concern this early in the season, Elaine Cub, about safrinha corn that we might find a fundamental there of a short crop that could give U.S. corn a boost later in the season?
No, generally the upcoming forecast for their planting, for their soil conditions that have been planted, is pretty favorable. They've got moisture in the soil, and I don't think that we can really whip up too much of a bullish case from their weather at this point.
How about on the 3,000 trucks that are supposed to be sitting in a line on the BR-163?
Yeah. That's a problem. That is a logistical problem. And it's certainly costing a lot of money to the grain companies that have obligations and schedules, logistical schedules that they're trying to get fixed there or trying to get filled. But that's, you know, kind of similar to our backlog in the rail here in the United States going for the PNW. It causes a lot of problems for the basis in the northern part of this country, of our country, and the western part of this country. And it probably causes a lot of problems for those grain companies and their export basis down in Brazil. But it doesn't ultimately alter the supply and demand equations.
Jill Vaclavic, go through fundamentals for me just for the soybeans, just kind of what kind of crop we can expect out of South America, what you think our ending stocks in the United States might be, what acreage will look like, and what this all means to you for the soybean market.
That's quite the loaded question there, but South America is going to have a great crop. It's going to be a record crop. If Brazil's anywhere near the recent projections that we've seen, and Argentina's anywhere near the recent projections that we've seen, we're going to have plenty of beans from South America. We have to argue, like I talked about at the top of the show here, with this insurance guarantee, $1.30-something cents better than it was a year ago. You'd have to think that acreage here is going to be increased quite a bit. And despite all of this bearishness and what a lot of people would describe as being bearish fundamentals, we still got a $10.25, $10.50 soybean market, which is really pretty impressive when you consider that we were south of nine a year ago. So I don't know if last year was wrong and that $8.50, $9 beans were just way too cheap, or if this is perhaps right now a $10 bean market, maybe this is a fairer price given the fundamentals. But I see nothing but a healthy carryout. I mean, I kind of think that the exports could continue to impress, but, you know, I don't think we're going to be short of beans anywhere.
That reminds me, so it was last year wrong? Was it simply depressed by the very, very low price of crude oil? We talked about that a lot last year, Dan Zwicker. And is this a better real view of the marketplace this year with crude oil trading in the $50 range, as opposed to, I think it went down to $26 or something along those lines over the winter months?
Well, I think soybeans, I mean, what got everybody wrong soybeans last year is, you know, nobody looked outside the box, and they were all in the same box thinking that, you know, South America was going to have a big crop and beans were going to go to $8 or $7.50 or whatnot. And, you know, the grain companies lost a ton of money. It even broke one of them, almost broke them. You can just kind of look at some of the bottom line. So the farmers not only got ripped off by listening to their grain company advisor by trying to sell $9 beans to them, the grain company themselves got clipped also on that. Now, I think this year, I think soybeans still probably have some downside vulnerability. But technically, I mean, if depending upon how we close out tomorrow, you got to be real encouraged for another leg up in soybeans to new highs out of the fall low. But I think soybeans are making a major low in here, and I think soybean prices could really surprise everybody, even with all this talk of increased acres as we go into the late summer and fall months. So I don't know what my cycles are telling me, but they're telling me that the bean thing, if there's downside vulnerability, is now. Over the next 60 days, but if you can hold beans together over the next 60 days, then there's underlying fundamentals taking place that U.S. soybean prices are going to be much higher as we go into late summer and fall.
Well, I agree with most of that, and I think that downside vulnerability in particular, we should be watching that March 31st prospective plantings date as a date that almost always has a lot of volatility in these markets. And I was also going to kind of pick Dan's brain about cotton acres, because you look at the relative performance of these commodities, and soybeans are considerably better than they were last year at this time, but cotton prices, December cotton prices, are like 32% better than they were last year at this time. So I'm wondering, to what degree should we in the center of the Corn Belt be worried about cotton taking away acres from anything?
Well, to my understanding, the whole cotton acres and the states have all changed in the last few years. You know, California used to be, I think, the number one cotton producer, but due to the drought that they had and cotton was not eligible for irrigation, the irrigation was saved for the vegetable growers. So cotton acres went, pretty well fell off the cliff in California. Mississippi used to be super big in cotton, but they've been raising corn and soybeans down there. So cotton acres have kind of fallen off the cliff in Mississippi. We still have some cotton acres in Texas, but I guess the big growth in cotton acres, which I'm totally surprised by, is Georgia. I guess their soils are more adaptive. So we're seeing big, huge increases in cotton acres coming out of Georgia. And that really brings in a big, interesting twist to the new farm bill, especially with the ag secretary coming from Georgia and the Farm Bureau president coming from Georgia, that cotton seed now is going to be classified as a commodity. So it will be classified, so it will receive subsidies, and it'll probably come at the expense of corn, soybeans, and wheat, because there's the pie is only so big, and the southern guys are going to get some crop subsidies for cotton seed now. So I think... I'm not too sure why all that is happening, but Georgia has turned into a major cotton producer, and they're wanting subsidies for their cotton seed now.
So I want to come back to something. Joe Vaclavic, maybe you can help me, and I could just very well be wrong. But we spent, as I said, an awful lot of time last year talking about the very low price of crude oil. I went back and checked to see what the current lead option low was, and it was $28 and something or other. And we had a very low price of soybeans and corn last winter. We had a recovery in the crude oil price by June, and we had that same recovery in both the corn and the soybeans by that time. Some of it driven by weather, but I would suppose, you know, depending on if you're arguing from my side, that part of that might be from lifting the artificial suppression of the very low crude oil prices. And can you make an argument, along with Dan, that there is a higher view for soybeans in the future based on the release of this pressure off of the top of the marketplace for all commodities?
Well, the crude oil has a lot to do with everything. I mean, that's kind of the king of the commodity sector, and what crude does in a lot of cases, these other markets will follow along. I don't know if that's the thing that's solely responsible for what we've seen here, but when crude's down in the 20s, it's going to be really tough for any other commodity that doesn't have a really good bull story to do a whole lot. So it certainly helps. I don't know what the future of the crude oil market is. It just seems to me, like I said earlier, it just seems to me like the large speculator is interested in commodities. Seems like there's all kinds of money that's coming off of the sidelines and into these markets now. I mean, the stock market's the best example, and I think you've got money that's just chasing the stock market now and realizing that they missed the boat. Everybody and their brother is waiting for a 10% correction in the stock market to buy it, and they just haven't gotten it yet. I think commodities are not in that stage by any stretch, but there is some demand here, and there is some money that's clearly interested in owning, I suppose, what they appear to be as cheap assets. And I don't know if $50 crude's cheap, but it's cheap compared to 100 or 150 where we were 10 years ago. So, you know, there's for whatever reason, and I don't know what it is, there is some interest in these markets right now.
Can you reconcile fundamentals with the optimism in the marketplace?
I really, the soybeans, if I could have somebody really explain to me with crystal clarity why the beans are 10 and a quarter today and why they were south of $9 at the same time last year, I would love to hear that, because I haven't heard a good excuse or a good reason why. Things just change. Prices change. These markets are cyclical. Attitudes of money managers change, and sometimes it doesn't have a whole lot to do with fundamentals.
Well, I think they were just making major lows a year ago, and that's all there was to it, you know. And it was just ripe. It was ripe for, you know, to be bearish soybeans, and everybody got in the same camp. I mean, the whole world was short soybeans. It just wasn't the U.S. The whole world was short soybeans, and then all of a sudden, the South American crop shortened up on them. And, you know, they had to make a major price adjustment. And now we haven't got that South American crop harvested yet, but it looks like it's going to be a big one. And we sure haven't got the United States crop harvested. We haven't even got it planted yet. So, you know, things can change as we go down the road. But, you know, it is 5 years since we had a major weather problem. So we are due for a weather issue, whether or not it's 17 or 18. My guess is we're going to see a weather issue. So a lot of this supply bearishness is on the table. I think the odds would say that that is going to tighten up over time. As far as crude oil goes, I think you just got to think Trump. I mean, Trump his goal is to get energy independence for the United States. So he's going to give a green light to the U.S. producers to pump oil. And I think if he is able to go for a border adjustment tax, then that makes the Mideast oil more expensive. So then that raises U.S. oil. So I think a lot of what the market is trying to figure out is how this Trump policy is going to play out in America First policy, and how the trade is going to work out. And I think that makes you want to be bullish commodities.
Energy First policy, all of the above, biofuels, coal, and oil, and natural gas.
Yeah. Now eventually that's going to make stuff cheap. But if we could figure out a way to stop sending all that money to the Mideast, that would be a great boost to our trade deficit, that we wouldn't have to buy Mideast oil. And we would keep that money here in the United States and do great for increase in jobs in America. And that's what Trump's policy is all about.
I was thinking about the fundamentals for the soybeans along, Joe, with the short crop you mentioned out of South America. And I know you've talked about this before on the show. There's also the Malaysian palm oil supply that was short in August and October, and I think it showed up in November and December as well. Elaine Cubb, can I get a final word from you, please?
Yeah, I'm glad you mentioned the global oilseed prices. I was going to put that theory forward. I would continue watching that because, the Malaysian palm oil market pulled back here at the end of February, and the timing of it almost exactly lined up with the pullback in soybeans. So I think these two markets are still linked and still being led by the global oilseed prices.
Joe Vaclavic, your final word for us.
This year is shaping up to be quite a bit better than last year for the U.S. farmer. I think most people that grow soybeans in this country are going to be able to make money this year. You got a nice crop insurance guarantee for spring. If you price whatever's not covered by crop insurance, you know, you go do that 15 or 20% of the crop, you're going to be able to make a few bucks here. Still plenty of time for the corn. I don't think a lot of farmers have sold a lot of new crop corn yet. I think that number around 420 December futures would make a lot of things start to work on a lot of farms in this country. And I'm fairly optimistic that at some point this growing season, or perhaps even before that, we may get a chance to price some bushels at that kind of price, or hopefully something better.
Dan Zwicker?
Technically, the market is positive here as we start the month of March. But I would tell farmers to reevaluate their situation every day as things move forward. And technically, just embrace the chaos that this market is going to throw at us every once in a while, and just hang on.
Commodity Week is a production of Illinois Public Media. You may listen to the whole of our program online, on demand, anytime you'd like at WILLAG.org. You can also pick up your tickets to the All Day Ag Outlook. That's next Tuesday at the Beef House in Covington, Indiana. WILLAG.org for all the details. Our thanks to our panelists this week, including Elaine Cubb, mastering the grain markets out of Elkhorn, Nebraska, Joe Vaklovic of Standard Grain from Chicago, Illinois, and Dan Zwicker at Zwicker Consulting out of Waco, Texas. I'm University of Illinois Extension's Todd Gleason.
Support for agricultural programs comes from AgriGold, celebrating their 13th year as a major corporate underwriter of Illinois Public Media's ag programming and e-newsletter. AgriGold's support allows their customers and growers everywhere to receive quality ag information at no charge. More information on AgriGold can be found at agrigold.com.